when you have great coaches, then after you have great coaches, you get great players, you have a great organization, and you tell them one thing. Just win, David.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of the Black Tuesday Podcast. I'm your host, Terrence Biggs. Our Malik Obi is on vacation in Hawaii. He is enjoying the sand, the surf, and pretty much everything that's going on in the tropical region and the beauty that is Hawaii. While I wait for my co-host, my guest co-host, Amtha, to call in, I need to discuss quickly the goings on this weekend as far as the NFLPA Bowl and the East-West Shrine Game. Both had interesting players that the Raiders might look into as far as guys like Omar Bayless, James Robinson, Jonathan Ward. The offense needs some sort of boost as far as dynamic production. And I think that the team needs some sort of infusion of young talent because under the current circumstances, I just don't see them being able to capture a division, especially with the Chiefs now in the Super Bowl facing the San Francisco 49ers in less than 2 weeks. The Chiefs are a young team, and the Raiders are young as well, but they're not as physically gifted, skilled, fast on the offensive side of the ball. You don't have a burner receiver. You have an explosive running back in Josh Jacobs. You have an explosive tight end in Darren Waller, but you don't really have that one go-to receiver or that one go-to backup where you can throw him like a short screen and have him take the ball 30, 40 yards and possibly house one. And it's one of those things where you look at the concept of the team and you look at how things are being built and you look at how, as far as the complete offensive scheme that John Gruden has tried to implement now entering year three, it is tough to imagine that there won't be some sort of offensive upheaval in free agency in the draft. John Gruden likes to tinker. He likes to put his guys in his spots. He has turned the roster over to a great extent. Now it's more time to add those bits and pieces. And I think that the team needs some sort of punch where they can play off receiver. They can jam receiver. There is separation, but there's not, I mean, it's just not really what teams would be afraid of. It's that lack, total absence of fear that anyone can see. Hey, there's Tyrell Williams, there's Zay Jones, whoever else, not really doing anything. We can play them honest. And it's one of those things where you look at it, and it's just these bowls, especially the combine coming up. Now, actually, this week is the Senior Bowl in Mobile. And a couple of weeks, about a month, you have the combine at the end of February, where it's the chance and the hope that Gruden and Mayock can come to a consensus and start to help that offense, especially help the defense, too, which we've said it time and time again. All these times, they have a abysmal and it's one of those things where it's just, it's tough. It's, you look at everybody from the Tahir Whiteheads to your Nicholas Morrows to your Markel Lees. And it's just, it's a struggle. It's really a struggle to see how they're going to totally renovate that defense. And I just don't really understand how they're going to have to sit there and it's a slim picking as far as draft, as far as free agent linebackers, but in the draft, there's a plethora of linebackers that would fit Paul Gunther's scheme, and they would provide suitable. Oh, we have our co-host Em. Em, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, I'm doing good. So sorry I'm late.
Em is one of the best followers on Twitter. She brings a different type of view to the world. Her worldview is interesting. Now, Em is a professor. Now, what made you want to get into the academia as far as a profession?
Hello?
Hi, no, I can hear you. That's a big question. I don't know. It's one that I'm asked to answer all the time, but it's always in the context of somebody who is trying to either give me a job or some kind of opportunity, and I always feel like I have to say what they want to hear, right? Which is that I would like to educate kids and elevate knowledge and make a big difference in the world. And all of that is true. But honestly, I wanted to get inside the ivory tower, which is another way of describing academia, which I think is really apt because it's very white. I wanted to kind of affect change from the inside. You know, like you can't improvise until you've mastered the discipline of something. So I kind of wanted to see what I could do as a kid who was kind of poor and college didn't seem like something that was an option to me when I got in there. I said, oh, okay, here's how I would do it differently if I were teaching this class. And then I'm trying to do that now.
Now, before we jump into the full conversation, I see that my co-host, Malik Obi, is apparently joining us from Hawaii. Obi, good to see you. Is there anything you'd like to share?
Hi, say it again.
I'm sorry, I was talking about, I thought my co-host had called and he has a quick announcement, but when he jumps back on, we'll get to him. But I want to ask you one quick short question as far as your choice of the ivory tower. Like, coming from a background where there was struggle, now that you have, you're making inroads, serious inroads into academia, mm-hmm. When you look back at the path here, how did that get you, like, how did that get you to that point? Like, what was one thing, if you had to narrow it down to one specific thing that helped you on the road, what would it be?
Hello?
Oh, Obi, are you, all right, hold on. MP, hold on one quick second. Obi, you have apparently news.
Hello?
Obi, can you hear me?
Yes.
You have news? Something going on?
Yes, I do. So, hello, guys. I'm not on Hawaii. I'm at a luau, and I just proposed to my now fiance, and she said yes.
Hey!
Oh my God! Hey!
So this is a monumental moment for me. Just wanted to check in and say that, you know, we're here and they're roasting the pig and everything, and as in the umu, which is an above ground, they do that above ground instead of the Emu, which is below ground, but it's monumental. You know, we set it up with the Luau company to call us on stage and for me to propose. So it was a really great moment. I'm really happy. And, you know, that was, you know, I had to call in and give the great news. So, yes, I'm very happy right now.
Oh, my God, congratulations.
Congrats, man. Congrats to you and the future Mrs. Obi. Now, with that said, now you need to go and celebrate. Yeah, go in. You're in Hawaii. Go enjoy the sun. It's dark and cold here in Wisconsin.
Listen, it's 80 degrees. I'm going back to my Mai Tais because I have most of them. So I will see you guys on air next Tuesday, and I will be back online probably the day after tomorrow. So thank you all. I love you and appreciate all the listeners. And thank you, family. I had to spread this news, share this news with my family first.
So, oh, yes.
You know, I will definitely be back next week, and I'll have more news to share and more to talk about my experience. So here's toast to a great show, and to
thank you.
To new beginnings.
Good luck to you, man. Have fun. We'll definitely talk next week. Enjoy Hawaii.
Thank you. All right, have a good
one. All right, my man. Have a good one. Now, M, to you, as what was that one aha moment when you look at your path to academia? You're like, okay. This is going right. This is kind of going the way I want it. Let's continue with this.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just really excited also about Obi's news. That's cool. Okay, so one moment that made me think, okay, I'm doing right. I have a million of those moments every day with my students, but before I got to be in the classroom as an instructor when I was still a student, getting into the fully funded PhD program. So you can get into a PhD program, but you can also get funding or a stipend, which means that they pay you. So it's my job to study what I want forever. That's, you can kind of think about that way. It's not enough money, not really. But realizing when I got the letter of acceptance that I got into this program, and it's the program that I wanted to be at specifically because my advisor was there, and he's the biggest dick in my field, and I wanted to be specifically with him. When I got that news, I was coming home. I was in New York. I was working two jobs 7 days a week and getting my first master's at night. And I came home from one of those nights, and the letter was just my roommate threw it on the table, and I opened it up. And I just called my sister sobbing incoherently. I was just like, I can't believe. And I realized that it was just that little bit of faith that someone extended to me. It's faith in the potential, because it's for an archaeology program, and I had no archaeology experience, none. And so I try to extend that little bit of goodwill and faith to my own students in much, you know, much minor ways, not, you know, like, 7 years of guaranteed money, but I try to extend like a little bit of good faith to the students too, because I remember how big that moment was for me, just that somebody said, sure, you could do this. Does that make sense?
that makes complete sense. Now, I know as a professor, you have to kind of navigate the arduous task of not only being a professor, but also being a woman in academia. Is there a specific struggle that you have as a woman in academia that the average person wouldn't know about?
Yeah, I think the average woman could relate no matter what field she's in. Just because it really comes down to kind of being talked down to and condescended to, and especially I look younger than I am, and so there's a particular brand of older academic male sexism that's not sexual harassment, that's not being a skeevy old guy. It's this kind of paternalism and infantilism where they're... I believe that they mean well, I truly do, but it's kind of like, I'm not your daughter, I'm your colleague. And so that's really difficult to navigate, I think, because I actually do look up to these people as a mentor in many cases. And so it's kind of difficult to find and occupy my ground as a colleague and a professional while still accepting their goodwill, even if, and this is kind of a cop-out and it's letting them off too easy, but if it's old-fashioned, it's kind of an old-fashioned, like, Joe Biden level kind of sexism. Do you know what I mean? It's that vibe.
It's not so much like anything overt. It's that vibe of, oh, okay, we're doing this now, and it feels weird. Like, it's more like, oh, mm. Like, it's not, how to explain it, it's not in your face. It's just more of like in the air. Like, you can sense it. Does that make sense? Apparently we have lost him for a minute. She will call back. But we want to kind of discuss everything as far as her struggles in academia. She mentioned Joe Biden, and we definitely will get into the political aspect, especially with the impeachment proceedings in the Senate going on today, and there was a lot there. There was plenty of showmanship. There was plenty of, well, lying on one path, and there was just, I'm waiting for the tweet storm. I'm waiting for that moment where you see an unfettered avalanche of tweets where it's just, there's that unfettered, like, it's just that feeling of, you know what's coming. Sometime this week, if things don't go the president's way, you're going to sense it. It's going to be ugly. And it's going to be the worst. It's going to be the absolute worst feeling where you can see it all over the place. You're going to see it on MSNBC. You're going to see it CNN. And it's going to be unrelenting. And now the whole presidency and the election cycle is going to focus solely on this. Where my concern is you have somebody like Bernie Sanders who seemingly is not really too keen on the whole impeachment process, but he is M's back. Glad to see you, M. How are you?
I'm so sorry. I am just like a little black chaos storm cloud follows me around everywhere I go. I think I'm back for good now. I apologize.
Welcome back. Now you were like, we were talking about the creepy aspect of some of the paternalistic type folks in academia. When is there, being a woman in academia, did you ever feel or do you feel now that there's a competition between women, or is it more of a sisterhood where it's a united front?
You know, I've had the pleasure of only being surrounded by extremely supportive women. I've heard tale of, you know, just like with all people, there are competitive individuals, and I'm not even sure that it's necessarily an inter-woman-on-woman conflict. I will say that I think that academia is kind of a den of vipers in that everybody is competing with each other. And I think that's why how supportive women in academia are to and with and for each other stands in such stark relief. So there used to be this conversation that was happening in my field, which is archaeology, about how there was this old guard of feminists, and they're the old types of feminists, and they do kind of have this mentality of there can be only one. But I think that the conversations about women in academia, women in period in this country, have changed so much that I don't want to reinforce that by even saying it. Do you know what I mean?
That makes sense. That definitely makes sense. I understand that. Now, even though you had class today, we'll get to the impeachment in a second, but I want to talk about intersection between race and gender. Now, when you speak of this intersection in a matter that concerns both, you speak with a clarity that is rare for many people, and it's a intellectual honesty that is rare. It is not something that you encounter, not something I encounter on an everyday basis, where I'm being told or I'm being explained to about race. And it's one of those things that, I'll be honest, as a black person, it just nails on the chalkboard.
Yeah.
Where do you think? How do you think your approach differs?
I think it's because I'm acutely aware that I'm white. And I've been teaching a race and diversity gen ed core requirement at a major U.S. Research institution that I don't necessarily want to talk about because I like my job and I'd like to keep it. But I've been teaching multiple sections of this race class, and it occurred to me that I have to knuckle up and stop being scared to talk about race. And it's not necessarily that I was scared before. It's that I didn't know what I was talking about. And by that, I don't mean that I didn't understand that white supremacy exists. It's that I literally didn't know what race was. So today in my class is the day that we talk about what is the definition of race? What is the definition of ethnicity? What are the modern legal definitions, right? And then I go through the U.S. Census Bureau with them and I show them how the definitions have changed over time. And then we sort of try to figure out if we really understand what we're talking about when we say race, and I don't think people do. I think that I have the sort of academic forensic understanding of it on the one hand, and that's what I deal with in the classroom. And then on the other hand, I have this lived experience of being in an interracial relationship and living in a diverse city, no matter which city I grew up in, lived in, or currently live in now. I'm not only around and speaking to people that I know and that look like me. And so I think that I had to kind of just get over my discomfort with it. And I think that's why I'm so hard on Twitter to Karens and people who are not yet over their defensive discomfort level of their whiteness. It's really frustrating to me because I have to be every single day. And so I'm just kind of a little bit impatient.
That makes sense to me. Now, when you see like Karens or you hear Karens in your everyday life, just outside of school, just in regular life, just as a regular human being, how do you fight the impulse to just set everyone straight?
I don't fight the impulse, and I know that that's a reflex of my white privilege as a white woman. I don't fight it. I'll say something. I'll say you're being very rude. My whole thing is to try to embarrass Karen, because embarrassment, shame, is the worst thing that can happen to a white person, I believe. And I say that as a white person. It's the thing we fear most, is being embarrassed or being in any way dislodged from our station, right, as we see it in terms of the social hierarchy. And so I can't think of specific incidences, but I always, if I see something, I say something. And if I don't care if it makes her uncomfortable in the moment, I don't say it in a mean way. I kind of say it in an obviously you're going to stop doing that way. So I think that I have a different attitude in real life, because there's a way to keep white people in a conversation in real life, and then there's Twitter. and I think that I have sort of a different attitude toward Karens in my real life. But like, how do you deal with it? Are you able to do the same thing?
Yes, because I think that, I mean, just on the physicality, like living in Wisconsin, when people see me, if I'm not smiling, people automatically think I'm angry. It's just my face. It's how I look. It is my not smile. It's just my focus. No, it's not focus. It's just my everyday smile. This has my approach. And people, there are times when there is a Karening happening in front of me and I have to say something. And it's because it's either addressed towards me or it's in my near vicinity and I just can't let it go. I can't just walk away. And when it's like outright world-class Karening,
Yeah.
And I have to just put my head down and just say, hey, this is how it is. And the worst is being lectured to, especially, like, I'll use the whole, you know, I know we'll probably get into the whole Bernie thing in a little bit, but the whole Bernie thing, like, Sheboygan, Wisconsin, where I live, is it has its share of Bernie bros, and there are people who are, oh yeah, because it's kind of like, Wisconsin's weird. It's a purpley state because all of the cities are Democratic, but they have a lot of farmland, and a lot of, like, small towns are just straight up dark red. And for me, it's interesting because the Bernie bros are sitting and telling me how profound and how great Bernie was and how much he has helped civil rights. And, like, as I mentioned tonight, this is the same group of fools who decided to boo John Lewis at the 2016 Democratic National Convention. And I'll be honest, personally, in my heart, I look at that, and before I tweeted that, I sat there and I looked at his speech, and I'll never admit this, but I'm just going to admit it because I'm honest. I got teary-eyed because I was mad. I was angry. I was furious because how are they going to treat somebody who literally jumped in the line of fire and just, you know, just boo him? Like, fine, he's not endorsing your candidate. That's fine. Be respectful. But they couldn't accomplish that. And to me, I try not to be petty often, but when I am, I am. But I'll never, ever forgive that. And it's something that will stick for me the rest of my life. Like, they did that man completely dirty for no reason. He wasn't bashing anybody. He was honest. And they treated him like garbage. They treated him like actual human trash.
I don't think that's petty of you. Like, I'm not going to tell you what your attitude or who you are is, but, like, objectively, from my perspective, that's not petty. They disrespected a civil rights icon. That's, you know, the disrespect of him and also Dolores Huerta. Like, it's the disrespect. See, here I'm starting to get heated. You can hear my voice rising. I can't with Bernie Sanders, and I'm like, my friends deploy me on people at bars. They're like, he likes Bernie. I'm like, really? It's like a weird, I can't let it go. I just don't understand how people can be bamboozled by him. It boggles the mind. I guess I'm just, it's just another way I'm disappointed with white people. That's my whole vibe.
I mean, for me, it's one of those things that, you know, you look at the entire election cycle and you follow as much as I mean, I'm still rather, like, still sad that Kamala Harris is no longer in the race, and that still bothers me, and that will continue to bother me because of, it wasn't that she would, like, her polling, it was more of how it happened. It was the lies told by the Burners. It was the lies told by the Warren folks that she's a cop. Or was the lies told, and if we don't keep it 1,000% real, is the lies told by some members of the black community who didn't think she was quote-unquote black enough to be a black president, that because of her heritage, she didn't pass some weird, strange purity test, you know, or her work as an attorney general, that, you know, she wasn't doing anything for the people. And there's that segment of the black community that needs just as much criticism as white people, where you know better. All you have to do is research and do your own homework and come to find out, you know. But no, it was more of the, you know, they saw her, and if we're going to be honest, they saw her having a white husband. Drove people nuts. Like,
do you think that's what it is?
Some of it is the fact that they don't see her as being completely black because of her Indian heritage and her Jamaican heritage. And I have talked to people who have said that. I've talked to black people who have said it. And it is, when your own people tend to do you wrong and say some wrong thing, it sticks with you, and it follows you. And there is that thought that she is lesser because, you know, she's not 100% black.
But did Obama face that? I mean, I was around. I don't remember that conversation, but I also wasn't on Twitter at the time and not really engaged in social media. I was. That's when I was doing all my working 7 days a week. Was the same conversation being had, not by birthers, but by, in your opinion, the black community? Were they saying that about Obama too, or is this unique to her, and do you think that's a gender thing?
I think that it's funny you mentioned gender, because there is an aspect of misogynoir in the black community that happened with Kamala Harris. And as far as Obama, yes, I've heard that too. When he was running for office, I've heard the exact same thing. Like, colorism is alive and well in the black community, where, I'll give you a small example. In my family, my mom was very fair-skinned, because my grandmother was, too. My dad was very dark-skinned. There's always been that little bit of coloristic thought.
Do you have siblings?
I have four brothers and a sister, and we are all different shades.
Okay, that was going to be my question.
And for me, it's just, there's been all that colorism.
Do you have, like, competition among the siblings? Because that's something that I know I've heard of with my friends and et cetera. But there's colorism within, or sorry, among the siblings, even from kids.
There, like, because there was like 10 years in difference between them and myself, I'm 10 years younger, they're all older. It was a different level of competition, but we were always measured against each other as far as, oh, this one was good at sports, this one is good at art, this one is good at music,
right.
This one's a criminal. It's different things.
Yeah. Wait, you're 10 years younger than the rest of your siblings?
Yes.
Your parents are awesome. I like them.
Yes. It was more of the... If we're to keep it completely honest, it's more the, oh, oops.
Oops, yeah, exactly. Your words, not mine. That's amazing. Well, yeah, getting back real quick to the Kamala thing, you know, I could talk about her all day. I faced a lot of frustration talking to my own people about Kamala Harris, because I think that people just straight up didn't know who she was. This has been my experience. They knew who Beto was. They knew who Cory Booker was. They knew who basically everybody else who counts was, but they didn't know who she was, because they're not like me. They're not addicts. They're not on C-SPAN watching, you know, the hearings, and they're not as it's shocking, but most people are not actually as invested in the political process as you and I and our Twitter friends are. That's been something that I've had to come to a revelation about. But for me, for my people who are predominantly other academics, who are predominantly white, they didn't know who she was. When they saw her, they would like her, but they didn't extend their support to her, because they said, if I don't know who she is, nobody else knows who she is. This was kind of the feedback that I was getting from other people, and I found that really frustrating. I found it frustrating, and I also found it weird, because I thought, well, why don't you look her up then? And so I would send them things and try to get them going, and my Facebook page was incredibly much about Kamala. It was basically only about Kamala and good things about her, trying to big her up. But it was, I think that she's better primed for the next election cycle, just the way that Bernie is now a household name. He has 100% name recognition because he was so in the news cycle last election. So I feel optimistic. I don't know if you feel the same way. I feel optimistic about 2024 for Kamala.
I think so, because in my mind, I think that Joe Biden's a one-term president. I have a feeling that he's run for president how many times? He just wants that one crowning achievement before he turns over the reins and goes off into the sunset and just kind of enjoys retirement, because he's going to be 84? Or 82 or 84 after this election.
Wow, I did not know that number.
Because I think right now Biden is, let me check how old he is. He is exactly 77, so he'll be 81.
Yeah. I mean, listen, his eyeball was bleeding at the first debate or the second debate. He's an old, old man. I am not excited about electing an old, old man. If I can put that aside for a moment, though, and this is something I'm trying to come to terms with, okay, I won't be excited about it, but I will proudly vote for him. I don't know if you feel the same.
Oh, yes. It is. How do I explain this?
Right?
I look at Joe Biden as that last gas station in, like, a rural road. You're starving. It's about, 1:45 a.m. You just need to get to the next city and kind of get to the hotel and go to sleep, but you're starving. Right. And I look at Joe Biden as that gas station hot dog, where it may not be what you want, but it's what you have.
Right.
And it's the best thing currently available.
Yeah, and you won't be hungry.
It's just one of those things. That's what he is to me. Like, I know, like, to me personally, he still has that Anita Hill issue to resolve.
Yeah, that's, I feel like I actually could, if she accepted his apology, if she was cool with him, I feel like I could get past it. I feel like we don't have a choice. I feel like we have to. We can still hold him accountable for it, but it's looking like it's going to be him, and we all kind of have to resign ourselves to that on some level. But what I would like to do is to try to have a conversation that's less about, like, oh, shit, here, we're sorry. I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss.
Yes.
Okay.
Feel free.
Okay, good, because I can't help myself. Shit, we're stuck with this guy, kind of meh. The way I've been kind of apathetic since Kamala suspended her campaign, I've been trying in some ways to not really engage in it or not think about it. I have so many other things going on that it's been easy enough to do that. But I'm kind of done not paying attention because I'm sad she's not in it anymore. I'm kind of done. I'm not done with her. I'm not closing any chapters with her. But until I know what she's going to do, and until she tells us what her next step is, I have to stop fixating on her. And I have to start thinking about the next person that I'm going to be donating to, supporting. And this time around, I'm going to, like I did for her campaign, I'm going to make calls. I need to be active and do stuff, especially because every single semester I yell at my students, you need to vote. You need to be involved in the political process. You need to be engaged and informed citizens. That's the whole thing that I'm doing. So I feel also responsible to them in that I'm doing the right thing too. I also feel guilt. I don't know what your attitude toward this is. I feel guilt about not doing enough in 2016. I ran my mouth, but I didn't actually knock on doors or make calls for Hillary. I honestly, I'm guilty of, I thought she was going to win. So, and she did, but she didn't get the Electoral College vote. So I feel like I have to do stuff for Joe Biden, and I feel like I can't in good conscience do it if I don't have a good feeling about him. And I'm trying to get there, Terry. Help me. I'm trying to get there.
It's difficult. Like, it's funny. I don't think he's an awful human being. Like, when I look at, you know, the scale of likability, because that's part of the candidate process, he is the most likable person remaining. Like, he has the likability factor where I'm not really trying to hear Elizabeth Warren, you know, co-opt a DNA test. I'm not trying to hear Bernie get angry and start railing on people. I don't want to hear right. Mayor Pete, you know, sitting there and trying to pander to the black vote when he is despising his own city by black folks. I'm not really too enthralled with a billionaire, either one, pick one. for Biden, like you said, we have, you know, people thought there's a large, well, not large, there's a pretty, you know, fair amount of the conversation that thinks that, you know, he's going to get that Obama rub where, oh, this was Obama's vice president. He's just going to ease in here and kind of do his thing and kind of, you know, slide in and say, hey, there's Joe. He knows Obama. They were cool for like 8 years. And right. For me, it's more of, I look at the field and I look at one thing. I mean, when you look at the Justice Dems and you look at they want the purity in politics and you look at, you know, Joe Biden, he wants to win.
Yeah.
And we're at the stage in the country where do people want that pristine candidate in their eyes or do they want to win?
Right.
I mean, if you think about it, the Republicans who could not stand Trump 4 years ago despise this. He was one of 13 candidates, and yet when it was time for them to come together, they did because they may not have agreed. Like, he made a whole bunch of promises that he has since lied, you know, proven he's lied about and went back on, but he still has a pretty significant base. And
the and fact that this man, Supreme Court,
exactly, he turned over the Supreme Court because of Mitch McConnell. Like, he, you know, Mitch McConnell, he who said that he wanted to make Barack Obama a one-term president, turned over the Supreme Court. And to me, it's funny you mentioned the Senate. When I look at McConnell and I look at other Republican senators, just as a person, what kind of moralistic contortionism does one need to do to completely sell out their ethics?
I wish I knew. I wish I could crack the code. I wish there was a way that I could convince people that I know in my life that that is wrong what they're doing, but I truly don't believe that they think it's wrong. I truly don't believe that these people who are evil know that they're evil. I don't think it's much deeper than that. This is what I say to my brother and other people in my life who tend toward the conspiracy theory kind of side of things. I'm like, it's not a conspiracy, bro, literal bro. It's not a conspiracy. It's all out in the open. It's greed, and it's no deeper than that. And they're doing it right in front of you because they know that you're going to look for secret clues to everything. They know that you won't accept what's right in front of your eyes, which is just simply that they're greedy. I don't know. What do you think?
I think people have to have morals to be able to contort them. And I honestly think that there are, with a few of those senators, there are discussions that were had that if you look at Lindsey Graham went from despising Donald Trump and saying that if he gets elected, you know, the country's in trouble, to flipping all of a sudden and becoming like one of his most ardent defenders. I have a theory. I cannot prove it, so I'm going to talk in vague terms. What I truly believe that has happened with Lindsey Graham is somebody knows something somewhere. And somebody got to him and said, hey, we know X, Y, and Z. You need to change your tune. He changed his tune. Nobody flips that bad saying the country's in trouble 1 minute and saying how great this man is. No one changed their tune that quickly. Overnight. All of a sudden, oh, he is not that bad. He's actually, like, showing true leadership. And for me, I'll be honest, where as frustrated as I am with the House and Senate, especially the Senate, I am more angry at the media. I'll pick one in particular. I'll pick one guy, and I'll focus on him. Mark Lamont Hill shows up on MSNBC, you know. Exactly. He shows up. He's in that Cornel West kind of like, you know, like trying to be Al Sharpton, there you go, D-Ray, guys like that, they tend to show up and want to, you know, espouse their viewpoint and try to speak for the entire black community. And for me, it's creepy. First, he voted for Jill Stein, so that should automatically disqualify anything that comes out of his mouth about politics ever again. In 2016,
100%.
He decided to be a Jill Stein voter.
Nope.
And I look at the media, and I honestly believe with everything in my heart that there are people in the media who would love to see a second term of Trump, because that's ratings and it's pay. Like, some fight to the nail. I mean, what are your views on the media as far as what you consume, as far as political discourse or political conversation?
I'm with you in that I'm incredibly frustrated with the media, obviously, and especially because of the fact that I know a couple of people in the media. I know people who have blue check marks and who are big voices. I know people who are producers for CNN. And I see what they say on social media as unfiltered themselves. And it makes me realize, and it makes me have to confront the fact that the people who work in the media have their own biases. And I think that that's a given, that's a very simple thing to say. But I think that it's important to understand that when you read what they're saying, for instance, anything the New York Times puts out, it depends actually on the reporter and not necessarily on the publication itself. And so that's been a recalibration for me, that these stories are produced by people and it's not some faceless editorial board necessarily, that these people are also accountable for the spin and for the stories that they're putting out. And personally, knowing people who are putting out things that I strongly disagree with, knowing actually what they believe and seeing the space between is really interesting to me, because I don't think that the American public is really good at nuance, and I don't think that the American public understands how important the media is in the political process. They think that the media is completely neutral, and it's not. I don't have like a fully fleshed out answer for this. It's just kind of where I'm at in my own thinking about it. I went from being just big mad all the time about the way things are being published to being like, okay, if we take it down to an individual scale for each reporter, is there a way that we can hold each one accountable? Is there a way that we can go onto Marco Monthill's Twitter and make him respond? And the answer is no. They're not going to listen or respond or care necessarily. So I'm not really sure that there is a way to change the way that the media covers politics. It's been doing it since the birth of this nation, basically. All media is biased and is used as a tool, an extension of the political establishment. So I think we're like trapped in it. I don't want to seem fatalistic, but I don't think that there's a way to change the way that the media does things, because as you rightly pointed out, it is about the money that they're going to make when they have a Trump to cover every day. It's the clicks they're going to get. I think it's beyond us. And I'm sorry to say that.
Like, for me, I look at that's like you said, you take an individual writer. Like, I'll use Maggie Haberman as an example.
Okay.
You know, how many different times do we have to hear about disillusioned Trump voters? Or how many different times do, you know, it just seems like it's a bunch of access journalism. It's tired. Like, yeah. Then no one has shown themselves or completely told on themselves more than the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
No one. They have completely embarrassed themselves as collectively, as a bunch of writers, and as an institution. And for, yeah, you know, they couldn't even get a singular endorsement correct.
I was hoping you wouldn't bring this up because I haven't fully thought it through, but it's just the disrespect. It's like two women equal one presidential candidate. I'm sorry. I'm just mad about it. I'm not sure that I have a good answer. I just can't believe that they pulled that shit is really what it comes down to. And it seems to me like it's almost overcompensation and it's such a slap in the face. And I'm not sure, I didn't want to talk about Elizabeth Warren, but I'm not sure that Elizabeth Warren's base perceives it as such. I don't think that they know that they're being mocked. Speaking of Karen.
I agree. It's that thing with, you know, even like there was a, speaking of Elizabeth Warren, I know that I'm not sure how much you want to delve into Warren, but I will delve into Warren as far as through the prism of a black person.
Okay.
This weekend, I think she's an actress, Yvette Nicole Brown tweeted that people should get off Elizabeth Warren and leave the DNA thing alone because for the longest time she would check boxes of being a Native American as well as black because that's something she was told and that people really shouldn't see Elizabeth Warren differently. And people lost their minds and people had to set her straight and she got really defensive and really upset. And I think with Elizabeth Warren, how do you trust somebody? You know, she said that there was a bunch of pictures of her friend that could prove her heritage, but no one ever saw them. How do you trust that?
She's a liar. I believe she's a liar. I know that as somebody with family lore and actually on my dad's side, it's a real thing. But nobody would ever check that box. Are you out of your mind? So for me, it's insulting because it's a decision that year after year, every time I filled out a form, I chose not to do that because as a 9-year-old, I knew that was wrong, right? So I get incredibly frustrated with Elizabeth Warren because she's a fucking liar. And that's really the bottom line. I know that politicians lie. I just know that lying about being a person of color as a white woman is about the gravest sin, especially now, in a time of rising white nationalist terrorism, when we have actual Nazis in the White House who are senior advisors, when we have an actual white supremacist president, when that is, for me anyway, the most pressing issue of our time, of this election, she's not my fighter. She's not the one that I choose because she lied and appropriated the work, the persecution, historical persecution, and the entire identity of indigenous women. And that's beyond fucked. And I can't get past my friends who are willing to get past that. I can't let it go. Every time I see them, I have to ask them about it. It's like a weird tick with me where it's just, to me, it's so fundamentally wrong that it's unforgivable.
It's the line, much like we had mentioned, I mentioned the Bernie Bros booing John Lewis, using a DNA test as a gotcha, as an aha moment. I mean, to shut the president and his followers up. That just it's not this. It's as near to disqualifying in my eyes as one thing could get, and it's the repeated lying of I was a teacher, and you were a teacher for less than like a half a minute.
Right.
It's the little lies, too. It's the little lies that, you know, when you look at the scope, just like you said, and I wholeheartedly agree, politicians lie. It's the nature of the actual game itself. But it's the little lies with things you don't have to lie about, things that are easily proven. Like they could prove, okay, you taught this long. You taught this here. Mm-hmm. I grew up poor, and really, like, my mom had to work. Your mom didn't have to work that long, like, while your dad was looking for a job. Like, she didn't have, and she went right back in the house. Like, she went right back to working at home.
You know what it is? the part, I'm sorry, I'm jumping in here because I just realized, anyway, back to me. I just realized that the reason I'm so heated about it is that every single lie she's told, like you said, it's a bunch of these little verifiable lies. Every single one of them is in the service of her own self-mythology persecution narrative. All of it is, I came up for, bitch, no, you didn't. It's all of these things where, and I see this a lot with white people, and I'm especially sensitive to it as a working class academic in a very much affluent field. I'm especially sensitive to these people who want to, who are pretending to slum it, basically, because you have no other kind of heroic narrative for yourself, unless it's, as a white person, unless it's a rags-to-riches narrative, right? And everybody wants to be that underdog. And I think Elizabeth Warren thinks that she does that white woman thing where she thinks that if she gets your sympathy, it's the same thing as respect. And it is not the same thing as respect. And I know that for sure because I have actual real stories like that that got me fucking nowhere. In fact, they count against you. So it's also seeing her use it and appropriate it and it getting her ahead that just fucking pisses me off. It's just unbelievable that it's such a separate standard. And even if I weren't comparing her to Kamala, I have to think about the fact that Kamala actually had obstacles that she overcame in life, and not fucking once did she go out there and talk about how hard it was for her. It pisses me off when white women, period, do it. It especially pisses me off when the woman who wants to be the president of these here United States is pulling that shit. It's weak.
It's the worst. It is one of the... It shows character or lack thereof, and it shows the fact that many of her followers are willing to let it go. Like, to me, being a black man, you know, my heritage is very important. I got two little kids. They're 5 and 3. They are biracial, and they will know each side of their heritage, and I will stress to them with as much strength as I can muster in my voice how serious and to be respected each side of their heritage, each part of them is. It makes them whole, and it's their life story. It's their story. Like, years from now, when we're, you know, all just pictures on the wall and their kids and their grandkids are right there, they can tell the stories. Well, my dad was this, this is what happened, you know, and it's truth. Truth is one of the things that are, you know, is most important. Now, we have hit on a bunch of heavy topics. Tomorrow is a special day.
Yeah, it is.
For one person. It is Wednesday. For one person, one person in particular, it is a special day. It is a day of celebration.
Yes.
Tomorrow is Anne's birthday. Now,
hooray!
She's blowing out candles. It's not anyone's business how many. She's just blowing out candles.
Don't worry.
There will be candle extinction wherever Anne is. Guarantee it.
Yes.
Now, with that said, what is the best birthday gift you ever got?
The best birthday gift I ever got was not one gift. It was a series of gifts that were given to me throughout the day, and they were all shitty gifts. They were all terrible gifts. What happened was I was in Athens for this year-long academic program, Athens in Greece. And for this year-long academic program, you go around and you travel to every excavation, every museum, and you're all on a bus together day after day after day for a year. So you get to know these people really, really, really well. So on my birthday in, don't worry about what year, in the 20-aughts, we were going around on a bus and we were driving around to Sunion. And in Greece, you have these things called peripteros, which are like kiosks. I don't know. They're kind of like bodegas, except they're freestanding and much smaller. And so at the kiosk, you can get beer, gum, stuff like that. and little crappy toys, like 50-cent gifts, 50-euro piece gifts for your kids. And so all throughout the day, every single person who was on this bus, there were maybe 25 of us, about once an hour or every half hour would come and bring me one of these little shitty Peripteral gifts. And it would be like a bag of chips or like a beer, a warm beer. It would just be some funny Peripteral thing that they had all decided that because it was my birthday that day, they were going to do. And it was just the sweetest thing. Just all throughout the day, it was, I've never, ever had a birthday like that. It was great.
Now, what was the worst gift you ever got?
The worst gift I ever got was a, and it was from the sweetest man, my ex, who is Persian, so he's from Iran, and he's an engineer, and he is a totally different culture than me, and so when on my birthday when we were dating, he gave me a very nice pen, like a really nice pen. I could feel from the weight of it that it was a very nice pen. I thought, okay, he's a nerd. That's why he gave me a pen. And then I went home and I thought, this is the most impersonal gift I've ever received. And I was upset. I tried to break up with him for like the 400th time. I was breaking up with him all the time, trying to. It never really took. And then he showed me the next time I went to his house, he actually collects vintage fancy ballpoint pens. It wasn't just a regular pen. And so in the end, it was a very nice gift and I was an asshole. But I just remember when I received it, I was thinking, a pen from my boyfriend? I was so upset.
Now, tomorrow, I know that you have a birthday festivities. Are there any like special foods that you're going to eat, or is it just, you know what, I'm going to get up, I'm just going to go and just do my thing all day long?
Well, tomorrow I have a couple of work things I have to do in the morning. I don't have to go to work, but I have to do some grading and make some calls. But then I'm going to get this high tea with my friend at a restaurant, a hotel here, which I don't know if you've ever been to high tea before. I've only been twice before. Do you know what that is?
Yes, I do.
So I only kind of know what it is because I took her at her own request to high tea at the same place for her birthday about a month ago. And I was not dressed up because I didn't realize you had to dress up. So I'm getting dressed up. We're going to get our nails done. We're going to high tea. And then we're just going to go back to her house and get sloppy drunk and smoke weed for the rest of the day.
See, that sounds like a plan. Like, that sounds like a much-needed plan. Now, we always end with a food question, so I got to ask you. If you could pick one dessert, like, it doesn't have to be from a specific place. It just has to be the specific dessert. Right now, what is one dessert that you wish that you had in your fridge or on your stove or on the kitchen table?
Ooh, that's such a good question. I'm not really a big sweet person, and you have to answer this when I'm done. I'm not really a big sweet person, but I am a sucker for flan.
Really?
You've ever had flan before? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh my God, the caramel. Ugh, it's ridiculous. I don't know why. It's wobbly. It's not something I would normally be into, but it's just so goddamn delicious. What about you? What's your favorite? Yeah. It's a hard question.
Honestly, there's a place in town. They have a. This is my new favorite dessert. It's a sea salt caramel cheesecake. It is sea salt caramel cheesecake. I can't even explain how good it is. It's like I used a metal fork and I swore I saw the fork just melt because everything was so soft. It was perfect. It was literally like the most perfect dessert I have had. And it is just, it fits everything. And it just fits the entire, like, moment of just having that little quick dessert after you have, like, because normally there's a place here, I'll go have, like, a tequila sunrise, but also we'll have, like, a slice of that cheesecake. And that's a weird combination, but it works for me.
Yeah, it is.
And it just fits right. Like, it's a happy place. Now, I know that you probably had a very long day, so I will definitely say this. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope this wasn't as tense of an experience as you anticipated.
I was so nervous, and I'm so sorry about my technical difficulties, but you make it really easy to talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Emma, and have the best of birthday. I'm looking forward to various stage of tweet and hilarity ensuing.
All right, then. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. Have the happiest birthday.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of... Hey, have a good one. This has been another episode of the Black Tuesday Podcast for my co-host, Obi, who is enjoying his new engagement. We want to congratulate him, one of the most stand-up people that you will ever meet. He is family to us. Love him like family. Congrats to him and his future missus. For everybody else, take care of yourself and take care of each other. Good night.